You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. I'm your host, Taylor, and this is my first Saturday afternoon show, but this is the new permanent time slot. So every week, Saturdays at 4 p.m. I'm really excited to have back in the studio Rachel Dolezal, who was on in August or so. She was on this summer to talk a little bit with me about intersectional feminism, racism, classism, sexism, all the isms that people often don't like to talk about, but we're going to talk about them anyway. So, yeah. Thanks for joining me, and yeah.
Yeah, for sure. It's good to be on again.
And have the whole hour, so.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We're here primarily to promote an opportunity that's coming up for people this coming week, Thursday, if you're listening to the podcast or live right now. This coming Thursday, the 16th, is the first in a series of how many courses?
Six.
Mm-hmm. Six courses.
It's a six-week course. So every Thursday for 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And what type of course is it? What's your
role?
Yeah,
it's an Africana community course that was started last year. And essentially, it happens in the fall and in the spring annually. And it's a collaboration between Spokane Community College, Multicultural Affairs Department, and the Africana education program at Eastern Washington University. And it's a community course that's free and open to the public. There are some options for credit for college students if they attend all of the sessions, but it's really uniquely one of the only Black history and contemporary socio-racial commentary opportunities for thinking people in this area to attend, that you can bring your family, your kids, you know, pretty much anybody that you want to engage with this information.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. And you're hosting the first one this
Correct.
Coming Thursday.
Correct. Yeah. And actually last year we started out with an intro and origins to Black studies, to African history, African American history. And then we kind of branched from there into sociology, politics, education, arts and culture, et cetera, from that kind of origin point. And then this year, our focus, particularly in the fall session, is going to be race relations in America. And it's a very kind of up-to-date and taking the pulse on the situation right now. So a little bit, you know, for sure there will be historical framework and context given in each of the lectures, but we're really looking at what's happening now, what can we do about it, where do we go from here?
Great. So and we've talked a little bit that you'll be focusing or using Ferguson, Missouri over the last 2 months mm-hmm. as a focal point.
Yeah, that's kind of our launch point for sort of an indicator of where we're at in regards to race in the United States. And those protests still ongoing, even mm-hmm. today, and, you know, why they exist, what that's about, why the controversy, why the shooting happened, why Mike Brown's life is being scrutinized, arguably more than the officer's life that shot him in terms of morality and ownership. And, you know, basically, like, why are Black victims of these police shootings and that have happened now across the nation in recent times, alarmingly at a frequent mm-hmm. rate. Why are the Black victims being put on trial for their own death, their own murder? So we're going to talk about that. The title of the talk on Thursday is Ferguson and Race Relations in America. Are we headed toward a deeper racial divide or a post-racial society? Mm. And with the election of Barack Obama, some imagine that we were at that moment of achieving a post-racial era mm-hmm. and moving into something that would just be, you know, colorblind status and everybody's the same and opportunities are the same now. And we've seen that actually the election of Obama has brought out some very ugly aspects of our society that are still alive and well, shamefully. And so we're gonna talk about how Ferguson brings out, kind of sheds light and uncovers what's really going on in America. And then the next week, the October 23rd talk is going to be Miseducation of America, and that's going to be by Dr. Jeannie Baines. And so looking at what's going on in our schools, and she's also a professor at Eastern Washington University in Africana Studies. And then the third week, we're going to look back at kind of like, what's the status right now for the incarceration situation, Black men and incarceration specifically? What's going on with that? A little update from James Wilburn. And then November 6th, History of American Lynching is going to be the topic. And all of these, again, are going to thread back to Ferguson. So what's going on in schools with kids is going to relate to race relations in America, and what's going on in Ferguson and what's going on with incarceration is, of course, in law enforcement is related. And then the history of American lynching. And we recall images like Emmett Till when we're discussing situations like Trayvon's murder and Michael Brown's murder. And then the last talk is politics and the media. And that's going to be by Dr. Asukile, who is new to the Africana Studies Department at Eastern. And November 20th, we don't have a speaker. It's actually the whole 6 to 8 p.m. time is going to be devoted to a group think project, which is like, where do we go from here? Reflection on and synthesis with all of those five previous weeks and kind of coming to some conclusions, possibly action plans for Spokane, and engagement with national events. And awesome. So, yeah, should be a really rich time.
Yeah, it sounds, I mean, I'm going to try to be there, especially now that I hear the whole lineup. Do you said thinking people being interested in the topic is the target group other than that? Kid friendly, as you said.
Absolutely. In fact, last year in the spring quarter, we had our spring session. We had some homeschooling parents even come and really study hard, you know, and research some of the topics that were being addressed and gleaned a lot of information from that course and implemented it into their homeschooling curriculum. So, I mean, it's kind of a
an awesome outcome,
right? A wide reaching. Audience, pretty much anybody can come. Free, open to the public. I mentioned thinking people just because it is going to be from an academic perspective, and yet that's only about a half hour or 45 minutes will be the lecture, and the rest of the time is discussion. So we really want people to come to have something to say too and to contribute. And so this is an opportunity to let other voices be heard and connections to be made from, you know, the standpoint of a kind of catalyst with a speaker and facilitator. So
cool. Yeah. And what, I mean, this is sort of an obvious question, but sort of not maybe. What level would you say, so as an educator, as a person of color living in Spokane, what is the level of importance for education? Like, where are we at with how educated people are on race from your observation, and where do we need to get to?
Well, I think unfortunately we're not at a very high level at all with education with regards to race, and especially race in North America and race in Spokane even. And that, I would say, the cause for that is partly there's a 1.9% Black population here in Spokane. So that's, you know, hovering on the 2% line. There aren't a lot of conversations that are equal in terms of numbers engaging in the topic. And a lot of times when something is brought up, it's an optional thing to attend. So something about race, you have to kind of care. You have to show up and be there. And sometimes it ends up being kind of preaching to the choir. So as a whole population, I believe we're not getting there. The school system does not require Africana studies, you know, in K-12. And so there's a huge deficit. Our kids are going to school, you know, 8 hours a day and for year after year. And what they're hearing is a Eurocentric view still in curriculum. And without curriculum being evaluated and restructured and rewritten to include all the perspectives and voices that are equally meaningful to that dialogue, there's going to be a huge gap and a big hole there. And so, you know, people are products of their social conditioning. And when it comes to the idea of race as a worldview, we talk about race as a doing, not just a thing that exists biologically, because the biological reality that was purported as existing has been, you know, debunked, and it's been proven that, you know, we're 99.9% the same biologically. So, and that 1% remaining, or the less than 1% remaining, is still, a lot of that's not due to racial characteristics. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the biological argument is dead. And so race is something that we do to each other. And so we racialize our curriculum from a Eurocentric view. And I think a lot of times people will say, oh, that's just identity politics, or you're just playing the race card. And why do we have to talk about race? It's like, we already are talking about race because it's being done to us in our businesses, in our schools. It's being done, it's being a system, a hierarchy of viewpoints is already in operation. So,
yeah. And then at the college level, so then you get the happy task of undoing a lot of this
right
Eurocentric understanding that people have built over years, and many people who either went to college before there was a larger focus on, you know, diversity studies, or just having to get out of your comfort zone and major a little, or people who are not going to college now, a lot of people never receive that opportunity
right
to correct that. And that's what you described it last time we talked, as a corrective.
Educational corrective, for sure. And that's, you know, sadly, Eastern Washington University is the only university that has a Black Studies department here in the area. But gladly, I do have the opportunity within that department to have these real conversations with students. And it's interesting, in, say, a race and culture studies class, a 100-level class, with students coming in and their first paper, their first response to definitions of race and ethnicity and culture, and, you know, just engaging with that is, oh, you know, why do we have to talk about this? Why can't we just all get along, kind of Rodney King style, you know? Why can't we just all get along? And I think that it's sad to me sometimes that that's like the first thought is, let's just not talk about it, or we don't need to talk about it. But because that is the first thought, that's also an opportunity. And so it's also exciting that there's so much to do over the quarter, over those 10 weeks. Yeah. And we go into, you know, all kinds of things with regards to eugenics and, you know, again, race as a worldview in North America and before North America, you know, the origins and evolution of that worldview, really. So, and how, and the intersections of, again, patriarchal power and capitalism and imperialism and white supremacy.
Seems like you can cover that in 10 weeks, right?
Yeah, well, in different courses cover it in different ways. Mm-hmm. So Black feminism is going to cover it from, you know, in one particular way and style and voice, and race and culture studies will be, you know, from another perspective within that perspective or whatever. And African history is certainly one of the most rigorous courses because we go back, you know, 2.5 million years ago, human origins and tracing bloodlines and the evolution of civilization and looking at Black African civilizations that are typically not mentioned in, you know, as the first civilizations in the world's history. So
Yep, lots to do.
Yeah. And then we have this really, I'll be really interested to hear how this is covered in the course when we talk about, you know, race relations today, mm-hmm. the 21st century, and how much they look like a regression, really. I mean, you mentioned Obama, and in a lot of ways, it looks like the 30s or 40s in the right. U.S. People have been mentioning the 60s, but really, even if you look at pop culture, mm-hmm. I'm interested in the media one. I mean, you have white, you know, European actors playing, you know, North African
right.
historical figures like they were in the 30s and 40s. All of that unfolding.
You're probably speaking
still.
To the Exodus or the, you know, yeah,
the new Exodus. It's Christian Bale. He looks like he'd fit right in.
Right. Another Charlton Heston.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, and that's actually, again, something that's connected to curriculum. So a lot of people might go to that film. Hopefully nobody goes to that film. We need to boycott that film from my perspective, because it's miseducation, it's misrepresentation, and it's highly offensive to the people that actually, you know, were living during that time. And also to people today, it's robbing and shredding ancestry and history. So, but if people go to that without knowing, and again, just with the typical public education system, then you're going to probably think that that's how it happened, because yes, you know, Greece did invade Egypt at some point. So it must have been during that time, right? You know, and all of the darker skinned people must be villains. That's pretty natural. I mean, we accept that under mm-hmm. the white supremacy tradition, and, you know, the lighter skinned folks rule in our upper class. And it's just, you know, it's really disturbing that this is still something perpetrated, you know, for especially with kids too, because they're conditioning over their identity, race, gender, culture, just, you know, sexual orientation. Everything is happening in a very vulnerable way. And so a movie like that is sheer propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been a lot of kind of, I don't know, good examples of that coming out. And then the other side of the coin of kind of doing a very surface level, you know, mm-hmm. rebooting Captain America, but, you know, let's just have this traditionally white character. Let's just make this character black, you know,
right.
Without going into the backstory and writing an actual story for this person, without mm-hmm. giving this character like the dignity of having a story, just right. slapping, you know.
Yeah. Well, let alone just how about writing, you know, making a movie of Black Panther and Storm.
Yeah.
You know, how come they don't get to appear? Is it yeah. because of, you know, associations with Black Panther Party, which of course have nothing to do with Wakanda and what happened in the Black Panther superhero's life. But, yeah. you know, what is that? How is that connected to race fear in America and in Hollywood? And, you know, that just being... If indeed we were, which indeed I don't believe we are, moving toward a post-racial society, I would argue that we are headed toward a, you know, whether it's a deeper divide or it's just we are aware now of the divide that's widening. I think for sure something like the ongoing white supremacy in Hollywood should be kind of like a marker for the fact that we aren't going there. But if we were going there, then certainly we should be having all kinds of black superheroes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like,
yeah,
like it's just an interesting kind of cop out. Like, oh, we're post-racial, so we can just leave all the, you know, heroes and superheroes white. Like, what's wrong with that? Because color doesn't matter. Interestingly, it benefits one group.
Yeah, it starts over to and matter. Over. It starts to matter when you have a discussion about Santa Claus or Annie. Mm-hmm. You know, God forbid. But
well, and then there's the Orange is the New Black too, which a lot of people think is just so amazing and so empathetic to people who are, you know, in prison. And I think it's terrible. It's like white is the new white. I mean, here we have another white main character in the film, and we are supposed to, through her, gain empathy for a situation that targets and institutionally and historically systematically targets people of color. So it's pretty weird that people think that's a progressive show.
So and I have definitely watched it, and my gut reaction was largely, and this makes sense in some ways, was to notice the, you know, that it's a show that actually has multiple female characters, and there's mm-hmm. many multi-layered female characters. So the feminist aspect, you know, I get all excited about that. And I'm like, wow, mm-hmm. you know, women's stories told from a basically female perspective. There's mm-hmm. female writers on the show, and really didn't dig into or even notice. I noticed some of the more overt racial stuff going on. There's definitely uh-huh. a lot of stereotyping on everyone. Roles. But right. I think, you know, it's done in this more kind of sneaky, more mm-hmm. modern kind of cheeky way almost. It's there's some cheek to it, so a lot of people accept that more readily, I guess, including myself when consuming the show mm-hmm. uncritically, right? So there's a perfect example, and you know, right. because the white main character is self-conscious about being like that white girl in prison, you know, mm-hmm. it takes the focus off of what's happening.
Right. That's really interesting. And yeah, she's got 15 months. We forget that what she did, you know, with 15 months, most black women would get, you know, at least 5 or 10 years. And so we feel so sorry for her, for her 15 months, you know, sentence. And and it's kind of like, why is this not mentioned? Why, you know, where are all the guards and different situations? I mean, it's just not, it's presented as reality and it's fantasy. And yet there's a certain aspect of it, the real aspect of it, with regards to, like, say, her shorter sentencing, for example, is just not even made visible. So whatever is real is not really visible. And then it, you know, there's this huge, crazy eyes and the angry black woman syndrome, and just the whole portrayal of black women in the film is really awful. So it's, yeah, I don't know. Once again, you know, we have like Blood Diamond and a Leonardo DiCaprio main character, you know, it's like, okay, Blood Diamonds, it was supposed to be about how this was affecting indigenous people in Africa, not, you know, mm-hmm. Europeans or, it's you know, the, so it's always like, oh, let's make a main character as some hero in the cause. And then the sub characters are actually in real life who are affected by mm-hmm. topic.
Yeah. Well, and we see it outside of fiction. If you look at the way that Ebola is mm-hmm. being covered right now, you know, it's all about the, you know, people complaining that, like, we, the implication being white American people, mm-hmm. shouldn't have to go, you know, we shouldn't be expected to go help. And, like,
right.
there's a lot of really, you know, colonial, imperial attitudes getting expressed that are also racially coded. But again, it's this sophisticated, it's this 21st century political racial coding that we have, where no one comes out and says anything overtly racial, but mm-hmm. it's still,
yeah, there's still that in there, that huge gap in terms of value of life,
mm-hmm.
my life versus their lives, mm-hmm. you know, and us and the whole us and them and the otherness that has been attached to white supremacy. And I think that definitely I mean, people are asking, like, why do the white folks get the serum for Ebola and nobody black got the serum? Why did the guy in Texas die, you know, and the white people in Atlanta, you know? So it's just kind of like, those are some real questions. Is this being used as a biological weapon? You know, arguably it's existed for a while. And why is it, you know, is this another massacre of African people, you know, without compassion from us because we don't want to touch the unclean or, you know, be bothered by those other people's issues or whatever. But again, there's a lot of fear at the root of those issues and topics and differences or perceived differences.
Yeah, fear is probably the key term. But if you're just joining us, I just noticed what time it is. You're listening to Praxis on KYRS, talking with Rachel Dolezal about the upcoming community course jointly hosted by multiple of the local academic institutions here on race relations in the U.S. She is teaching the first one this Thursday, the 16th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at SCC, Spokane Community College. And it's centered on Ferguson.
Right. And it's actually in Building 6 in the Littlefoot Room, Littlefoot A and B. So, yeah.
Awesome. So what Do you want to talk about Ferguson a little bit without, you know, without ruining your lecture for Thursday? Because we want people to turn out to it.
Absolutely. Let's do that. If anybody hasn't heard, there was a shooting by a white police officer of a black child, 18-year-old Michael Brown, and he was shot 6 times, 2 in the head. And there still remains like no clear list of facts over what exactly happened, because as reports will tell you online anyway, and the U.S. Department, Eric Holder, has ordered a third autopsy. The shooting, because of the nature of the controversy over the situation with the individual's death, who had, you know, no criminal record and was not charged with a crime and was not implicated in a crime at the moment he was shot and killed by this police officer, who, by the way, was an ex-member of a fired police force that had been fired due to racial, racist and criminal allegations. So he was a part of a police force that is on record as being racist. And then, you know, now he's in a situation where he has killed somebody's black son. And that those connections definitely lead to a lot of anger, a lot of confusion. And I think that we can't ignore that there are 400 years of history leading up to this moment. And so race is kind of like this big, it's like a big iceberg. And we just see the tip of it typically when we're wandering around and seeing, you know, somebody that looks different than we do or whatever downtown. But underneath of the water are, you know, things like chattel slavery and things like genocide of Native Americans and things like, you know, horrific acts, eugenics and Hitler, and all of that is under the water. And so when this little ship comes along and tings the iceberg, I mean, that's kind of like what happened in Ferguson. There's this moment where then it sets off all these conversations that not only are about that little incident, which seems little at that moment. It's a huge incident because I have 2 black sons and it would be huge. I can't even imagine the terror, the horror of knowing that your son's life is lost forever and he was a good kid and, you know, you'd put in 18 years. A lot of time. Anybody that's raised a child, it's a lot of time. My oldest is 20. So, and to know that loss was perhaps, I mean, the only, you know, reaching for a why? I mean, there was indeed, by all the protesters' perspective and by my perspective too, I would share their concern over the racial connotations of that shooting, that he was caught, you know, on the street while black, like walking while black. In America, you can be, you know, harassed and or killed. And we've seen over and over with some 20 plus cases in the last few years across the nation where black children are killed, teenagers, young men. And these are all, you know, most of them are black males, with a few exceptions of even like a 7-year-old girl and Renisha McBride and a few females. But it's so demoralizing, and you reach this limit where it's just like, we cannot accept this. Something has to give. This person we cannot have another George Zimmerman walk free, mm-hmm. and say that by walking free that black life has no value. We cannot say that our children have less value, let alone are not even seen as human beings that are worthy of, you know, justice being done on their behalf. So that's really kind of like that little ship sailing across and hitting that iceberg. I mean, that's like what set it off. And like I said, I mean, for people to be rallying, marching, standing, petitioning day after day, there's been no break. It's incredible. I mean, I wonder, you know, we have like one rally or one march or something here in Spokane, and then everybody goes back about their business the next day. If there is something that brought us together in that kind of, emotion and that kind of passion and that kind of sense of this shall not happen again. We will be here. Things, you know, we are, I saw today a group of Black youth that had written in large numbers across their forearms the bail number for, and they, you know, were going to stand in front of the police department, and they were scared that they might be, you know, locked up or somehow punished. And so they, you know, like had the bail number written on their arms as their arms are in the air. Literally, like, that's what it's come to. That's, you know, I think for us to just kind of, you know, enjoy the fall season and go about our business here in another part of this country is kind of insanity. We need to be paying attention to why, and, you know, what has driven people to this extreme point where nothing is more important than driving the fact home that Black life has value and it has equal value and our kids cannot be killed.
Yeah, I mean, it chalks up to, if you think about, so we're looking at three this week, right? Mm-hmm. And we're talking about teenagers, we're talking about children, as you say, right. You know, that's not insignificant, but it's also not a wholly abnormal week in America, mm-hmm. right? And as far as, you know, meaningful dialogue among the people who are already having a meaningful dialogue, it's gone deeper and it's been better. But that's a small node of total dialogue, which is easy for me to forget in my comfortable social media bubble of people who mm-hmm. have a basic understanding of these things. Sometimes also, right. You know, I found out through this incident that a lot of my social media bubble isn't as pro-justice as I thought they were and mm-hmm. has a lot more deeply ingrained white supremacist attitudes than I thought they did. And that's part of, you know, everything bubbling to the surface. But it's, I think that the word terror you used is an important one. Mm-hmm. And you said the course is going to talk about lynching, the history of lynching. I mean, mm-hmm. it has to be called what it is. And if it's something that consistent, it should be considered terrorism, just under the dictionary definition of what that is. It's right. an ongoing politically motivated campaign of mm-hmm. intimidation and right. killing.
Yeah. Well, and arguably the first domestic terrorist group was the Ku Klux Klan, white supremacists, you know, you know, even before them, you could, yeah, I guess somebody could talk about slavers and whatever. But as far as actually oppressing American citizens, because prior mm-hmm. to the Emancipation Proclamation, there was no room for considering a Black American a citizen. But afterward, then that would have to have been, you know, if not the first, definitely right up there as far as domestic terrorist groups. And at one point, there were a few million KKK members, mm-hmm. no small group. This isn't like a little fringe something.
Many have been elected to right. public office. Many mm-hmm. still are in all likelihood.
And the Grand Wizard of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan in North Idaho just recently ran for sheriff in Bonner's Ferry. And, you know, that again brings back kind of harbingers of like it's like, oh, you know, remember the past. Like, here we are in the future. Maybe, you know, why is this still something that has so much power and so much traction? And it's not just the people in hoods. You know, Malcolm X was talking about soon the KKK is not going to be in hoods. They'll be in suits and running businesses and corporations. And we see, you know, the prophecy of his time coming to fruition. And it's just, again, I feel for everybody in Ferguson. My heart goes out to them. And, you know, I even want to, at some point, I wish I could break away and just go over there and stand with them for a day, you know, and I might, but just to support, I think that you cannot minimize the impact of standing with people. I know they had an interfaith, gathering last night here at Beth Shalom for show solidarity with regards to that particular synagogue being tagged with a swastika, and, you know, just standing against hate. And I think that those events are extremely important. They're crucial. We can't we can't know what somebody else is going through, perhaps within a group that's not our own, but to go and stand with them and say, I'm here for you, that's powerful. And so, you know, that's, and that kind of brings us back to Spokane in terms of policing here. And I know that there's a no sit lie protest today and other issues surrounding racial profiling and the police in Spokane. And so I think that, you know, it's easy to just remove it like, oh, it's in Ferguson, but no, it's here. It's in our backyard too.
Yeah. And it could be, I think in Spokane, correct me if you, I don't know, tell me if you disagree with this, but I think in Spokane, we have an opportunity to look at specifically our policing, mm-hmm. and which is still disproportionately targeted toward non-white men, mm-hmm. Specifically Native men and Black men in this community. Despite the small proportion of the total population, it's still right. disproportionate. Right. But I think when we have those conversations, we can say, you know, it's clear that this would scale to being a larger problem the way it is in other cities if, as there is now, a larger Black population comes in, a larger, mm-hmm. you know, Arab population. I worry a lot about that, seeing, you know, people coming from that part of the world, refugees coming into this community who are not, you know, we're not a welcoming community right now. There's organizations that do some of that work, but as far as people on the street are not there. And that's been clear in these conversations. So if we can talk about class, class as part of that with police mm-hmm. shootings, who gets killed by the police,
right.
You know, involvement with drugs, other types of profiling. Do you think mm-hmm. we can tie that in and show people?
Well, there's always an intersection for sure mm-hmm. between race and class and, oppression. Along the lines of race, class, and gender, and sexual orientation, and ability or disability, mental health issues is another kind of category. And, you know, any part of that protected class list that we do not discriminate on the basis of blah, 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 there's usually at least 7 historically oppressed groups mentioned. Those are historically oppressed groups. And I think that it's easy for us to forget that there's a reason why we name those groups. We will not discriminate on the basis of race for a reason, because it's happened for hundreds of years and it still tends to happen. So we name that we will not discriminate on the basis of class because it has happened and it tends to still happen. I mean, again, these are not just platitudes that somebody just pulled out of thin air. They set very firmly on the basis of a history of trauma and oppression. And so certainly refugees, people in poverty, people with mental health concerns, people that are, you know, living in Spokane, identifying visibly as people of color, definitely have a lot of not just targeting by police, but even, you know, comments and other things to navigate here that are pretty tricky. But that's definitely one of the main reasons why I applied, you know, to the OPO commission too, was to, you know, be eyes and ears in that particular scene for those populations that are underrepresented and underheard and typically don't have voices in power.
Mm-hmm. And for people who don't keep up with that issue, it's the Officer of Police Ombudsman Commission, which you were just elected to by the mayor, by the right. mayor's office, mm-hmm. with 5 others?
4 others. There are 5 of us total. So the mayor appointed 2 and the city council appointed 3. So right.
And mm-hmm. Can you just talk a little bit about the history for the need for that office, and what your new role is all about? It's a brand new program that's just starting. So
right. Well, some of the history, and, you know, people have different perspectives on what parts of the history stand out the most, depending on how they're connected to the issues. But I think definitely officer shootings, excessive use of force, asset seizure problems,
issues with the transient population in Spokane and how they're treated by law enforcement definitely all intersect with the call. But similar to the situation in Ferguson, really, where there's such of a like an uprising and a grassroots kind of just upswell of concern and so forth. That's what happened after Otto Zem and after other police shootings here. And, you know, I'm still in the process of reviewing the last 5 years of the ombudsman's reports. And within that, it's like about 20 shootings, deaths by police officers in Spokane in the last 5 years. It's a lot. I mean, 20 is a lot. And sometimes they don't get reported or don't, there's no contention if somebody doesn't have a loved one that actually files a report. So if somebody's shot and they don't have a family member living or in the area to fight for them, you know, like if Mike Brown didn't have a community to stand up for him and if nobody knew Mike Brown, then maybe there would be no protests right now. I mean, but that doesn't mean that it's not that it's okay, and it certainly doesn't mean that that particular person in their life had less value. So I think that definitely some of those things led to kind of this sense of, okay, we have an office of police ombudsman, but we also need a board of commissioners to a supervisory board for law enforcement to really be looking at. We need more eyes and ears and to decide and kind of recommend policies and procedures for police training, for city council to implement with regards to how this kind of shakes out in Spokane. I'm really excited, actually, about the possibilities because it's kind of like a really cool, I wouldn't say experimental process, but for sure it's cutting edge. We had the Seattle Ombudsman's Office doesn't have a commission. And most cities don't really have, you know, a very effective ombuds person mm-hmm. in place at all. So perhaps Spokane can become, you know, as not only to bring justice to some of the situations that already have happened here, but to prevent further situations and more horrendous situations from coming down the pipeline, as you mentioned, with other populations perhaps moving into the area. Certainly maybe we could become like a role model for other cities. And I really hope that's what happens, is that we, you know, demonstrate that yes, in fact, we can have effective police, accountability and supervision. I mean, what would happen if there was a, you know, in Ferguson, they have, lopsided so many, you know, white police officers, black population. And mm-hmm. what if there was a, commission of five people of color overseeing, you know, like an ombudsman there, would the situation be different?
Yeah. Hopefully their hiring policies would look a little different. You wouldn't hire someone right. who has a documented history of, you know,
racism and
racist behavior, policing. Assault. It seems right. to happen over and over again though. Mm-hmm. So that's another thing to remember. I mean, it's not as though the Spokane Police Department is alone in its history of corruption and misuse of right. power, but it certainly is, it has some standout history at the same time for a town this size. There's definitely a Wild West mentality going on
right.
for many, many years, and it's great. I mean, it took a lot of pressure. It took sustained. I know people mm-hmm. who have been working on police accountability in Spokane for 45 years, like who have put a lifetime of work into basic, like right. let someone else investigate you who isn't you.
Mm-hmm.
Or a, you know, renegade superhero type who has no legal standing, you know? I mean, that's really...
Right.
But we're finally getting some of that
mm-hmm.
basic stuff. And it'll be really interesting to see what new sets of eyes on the reports pull out
yep.
With all of you. And it's pretty, pretty exciting stuff. You've got a good diversity of experience and on the commission. It's pretty cool stuff.
Kind of speaking of that, on October 20th, our first meeting is open to the public. So it's at 5:00 in City Hall, lower level. And definitely, you know, 5 to 7-ish, but it'll be kind of like getting married in front of everybody and trying to work out. I mean, you know, it's our first meeting. Literally, we have not gotten together due to the regulations and policy for office meetings, officer meetings. So, you know, this will be our first time coming together as a group, and we will, you know, basically build our commission in front of public eyes. So, you know, it's definitely open for everybody to come and
set the tone. That's right. Transparency is what it's really, absolutely. That's what's been lacking. So, not to call anyone out, but you know, it's refreshing that you'll be transparent in your meetings. But yeah, if you're just joining us in the last 10 or 15 minutes here, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS in a brand new time slot, which is permanent and exciting for me. I don't have to rush straight from work on Monday mornings anymore. Talking with Rachel Dolezal, who's a local educator at Eastern in the Africana Studies Department, working on this community course, which is a 6-week course at SCC starting this Thursday, the 16th. Rachel will be the first educator, the first lecture, and then followed by discussion on the topic of Ferguson, race relations in
America.
In America,
right. Okay. Well, and I'm also going to tie it into Spokane.
Okay. And local.
Can't help but do that.
Well, because you're here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. So, and that is, again, it's open to the public.
Mm-hmm. At Spokane Community College and at 6:00 on October 16th, which is next Thursday, in the Littlefoot A and B room, which is in Building 6 on campus, over there on Green Street.
Cool. And I can post all that in the podcast notes, which will be up tomorrow with the podcast, which you can find. I'm updating all the info at kyrs.org under shows. So I'm getting my act together on that. So,
And another note about that, you know, we really encourage people to come with things to say and with ideas, because a big part of the course is not just lecture, but also discussion. So, and with that said, the community that attends these lectures really builds the next session. And so the topic of this session really came out of some of the recommendations for topics from last session. So we have a fall and spring session annually with Africana Studies at Eastern and in coordination with Spokane Community College. And we really do take seriously the reviews of each of those courses and the 6 sessions that happen each time, and then, you know, build the next one from there. So there's no set agenda for what we're going to be talking about in the spring yet, which is really exciting. So, you know, if people want to come to this and say, you know, this is what we want to hear next, that's also definitely an opportunity for the community to really build this with us.
That sounds great. It's good to just have, you know, adult community education happening in general, just as a general.
Right. And there's it's kind of rare to just be able to attend a lecture by a Black academic, you know, thinking professor, because I think that the PhDs in the Black community here are kind of, you know, slim, and, you know, again, at 1.9% of the population, we're slim in general. But professors are also, we a lot of times bring in WSU professors for this course. We did mostly WSU professors last time. From Whitworth, Larry Burnley has participated, and, you know, so we've kind of like brought together a lot of different, experts in the field over, you know, the last couple sessions. And I think that it's a great opportunity to hear from some of these, scholars in the field, from Black scholars, you know, specifically, that are dealing with these issues from not so much a reactionary level or process, but more of a really, you know, a really thoughtful and well-examined perspective.
Yeah, that's exactly what we need more of in general. And I was just thinking about how I forgot to ask you, your recent, your Inlander piece that is out right now. I also do commentary for the Inlander. mentions doing the recent, which I missed, the Spokane Faith and Values panel, which was on race.
Yeah, like race and prejudice.
Race and prejudice.
Mm-hmm, what was or racism and prejudice? Actually, yeah,
so. I missed that, and you're a panelist.
I know.
That. Well, I heard it was well attended.
It. They say it was the largest they've had.
Interesting.
And it's the only one I've actually been to, which was cool. I didn't somehow I missed the memo on that going on, and so I got a text at 9 a.m. On Saturday, and it's like from my great colleague and friend Regina Malvo, who's the CEO of the YWCA, and she basically said, like, you are the voice on this topic. You need to be there. There's this conversation happening this morning in an hour. And I was like, okay, well, let me, you know, throw some clothes on. And then when I showed up, one of the other panelists had canceled. And so they invited me to be a panelist. And so certainly I, you know, have thoughts, you know, ready at all times on these issues. Yeah. So it was a really rich experience, and was so honored to be included. And we, the panel included Gonzaga professor and a columnist who writes, answers like Ask a Jew questions. So I was kind of like, you know, we had a white guy, a Jewish guy, and then Regina and I, you know, so, and I think that we couldn't actually get to all the questions because the audience had a lot to say and participate, with that discussion. So that's again, our hope for this community course, that there will be, you know, with ample time for participation, there will be people that come with and are able to kind of like work out their thoughts and be heard and have their ideas considered. And maybe that can lead towards some rich solutions for our future in Spokane and, you know, ultimately the nation, the world. So,
yeah, I mean, I salivate at the idea of facilitated dialogue after being in the anything goes, you know, slash and burn world of comment threads and even what starts as friendly discussions on Facebook without someone who does have the authority to say, actually, I'm an academic expert in this field. And people's lived experience counts for tragically little in those forums sometimes. And it's good to have someone who can step in and facilitate the dialogue and make it a dialogue rather than an echo chamber that's just digging these deeper trenches. You know, we can't be digging in to these antiquated ideas.
And I think that definitely all of the speakers, you know, in this series too, and in the community course, every session have some lived experience, you know, to go with. And so it's a combination. It's like you can't just read books about it. You've also got to like walk through the fire. And but if you're walking through the fire, you need to know where the fire came from. And, you know, so I think that is a great marriage between academia and just practical application and stories, personal stories. And so hopefully we can get some of that to come together in the dialogue too.
Great. So what do you most, you've touched on this a little bit, but in the last few minutes, what do you most love to see when you're doing these educational opportunities? Like what makes it, is it like a life-giving thing for you after maybe some of these less encouraging dialogues you might have elsewhere? And, you know, what do you hope to most accomplish?
Yeah, well, I think that at the Faith and Values coffee talk, one of the things that just, you know, brought joy to me and to my heart was that there were so many people there. I think that first and foremost, people have to show up. That's what I love to see, is people actually getting out of bed and coming down on a Saturday morning and showing up, or coming after work on Thursday at 6 o'clock and showing up and just being there and showing that, yes, people are interested. There are people that are concerned. And if you show your face, that's a way of participating and kind of standing up and saying, you know, this is important to me and I'm here, not just for myself, but also for you and your children. I love to see that. It makes me feel like I have a supportive community, and that my son, who's at Sacagawea Middle School, has maybe, you know, maybe there are other kids and parents in the area that are interested in the situations that he has to navigate, and even in the curriculum their own children are being fed. And, you know, so attendance is huge. And I mean, just for starters. And then secondly, people talking and saying, oh, this is what I have, you know, this is my story, sharing stories. That's always really rich. It broadens the dialogue, and feedback is so important. I think that anytime, you know, I'm speaking, I, you know, even in my classes, I always do exercises and projects and, you know, ask questions, because I need to hear that not only my students are, you know, tuning into the information I'm giving, but also that they have ideas about it, and that, you know, if they have a question or a concern or something didn't quite register or resonate, that they're able to talk through that. Because that's the only way that we change our social conditioning and that cycle of socialization that has supported all of these oppressions, and, you know, enter into this new cycle of critical transformation. And really, you know, we've got to support that new cycle of liberation with dialogue, with showing up for each other. And so I'm excited about that.
Great. Well, shockingly, our hour is already done. So thank you so much for coming on again.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks.
I'll be
posting
all this information on the Facebook page, facebook.com/praxisradio. Next week, I'm going to have Robert McChesney on the air to talk about his book, Digital Disconnect, this idea that our technology isn't delivering in terms of actual connection. So, and this community course starts October 16th, 6 p.m. at SCC in Building 6, and I'll post all those details. Yeah, it's been Praxis with Rachel Dolezal. Once again, hopefully she'll be on more times in the future.
I'm always
interested. So thanks for listening. F Yes is up next, and I will be back next week. You're listening to KYRS, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.